Vibe Collective CIUT 89.5 FM. I am your co-host, Jams. Joining me in studio, my other co-hosts.
Adnan Hussein, sitting on the far left this time.
Right.
Mally, a.k.a. Docu Vixen.
And Adrian Worrell.
Adrian, hiding behind the lampshade.
Hiding. Can't see me.
And we're the Vibe Collective. We're heard every Saturday from 3 to 5. From 3 to 4, we normally have our roundtable discussions. We talk about important issues like decolonization, social justice, environmental justice.
Social justice, resistance culture,
and identity, and music, and we try to bridge those things together, look at the intersectionalities, and create dialogue, and hopefully include you, the listener, in that. Yeah. And
radical radio love.
That is it. Yeah, citizen journalism.
But this week we are all at the Feminist Art Conference.
Exactly.
Which is where you should be.
Yes. So hopefully you're in your car on your way listening to us. And Eileen Sova, who is one of the founding directors, organizers of the Feminist Art Conference, was our guest a couple of weeks ago.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And if you want to listen to that show, you could actually go to www.thevibecollective.wordpress.com.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Listen to all our archives.
Yes.
And it's at the Foundry, the Feminist Art Conference. And it's going on right now.
Yeah.
And Jams is actually one of the artists who's on display.
Oh, look at that. So modest. Didn't say a word.
I'm not actually on display, but I will be presenting or performing a piece.
Display.
actually, that was one of the really bizarre things I encountered at the Museum of Natural History in New York. Was at a certain stage, they used to have an indigenous family living at the Natural History Museum as a living exhibit.
Real family?
Yeah, and also actually...
That is so disturbing.
I think they were paid to be in Central Park as well, if I'm not mistaken, and to sort of paddle around and be a part of the landscape. Mm-hmm. Which is really interesting and problematic and, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how much was their income?
No income.
You were like mascot.
You were an installation. And that was it.
Live installation.
Yep.
I think the Central Park people were paid.
Well, yeah. No, the city must be,
not the person at the Natural History Museum.
That's crazy.
Although there was this whole process in which... there was one young man left after the other members had died off of his tribe, and the curator of the museum tried to adopt him, and it resulted in this whole long drawn out drama, and he ended up basically living in or around the museum for the rest of his days. It was a very strange and sad story.
Oh my gosh, it's so sad.
And kind of it speaks to this whole people on display thing. Like I was reading about the Hottentot Venus, was it? Am I saying that?
Hottentot
Venus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sarge Bartman.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting about these human beings just plucked from wherever they're from and put as exhibits.
And and the violence on her body after her death, even, and the disrespect and the violation. You know, she was cut into pieces and put on display in various... She was on display in Paris until 1988 or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Part of her body, anyways.
Yeah, yeah.
Part of her genitalia.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it was... There was this fetishistic fascination with her because she had enlarged labia, and I think also I forget that there's a condition that exists among the particular people in which they develop just a large amount of back fat and around the butt, basically.
I'm going to
I could say gluteus maximus.
I'm trying to see how dignified Adnan is going to
on display. But
not even funny though.
No. It was the native exotic, right?
Yeah.
The exotic and erotic of other on.
Yeah,
I mean it's so disgusting. Like how anybody could ever think. I mean, we can't be moderate when we talk about that. Sorry, I'm fired up because I just came from
the Urban
Alliance on gendered based violence, and in particular, you know, the browning of violence, and the silencing of other violence.
How was the conference?
Incredible and very inspiring, and that's why when I, you know, thinking about that right now, like it's so infuriating to think that these people think that it's okay to do that to other people because they didn't see them as people,
right?
You know, and it's still today, like that still happens today. You know, women in particular, you know, women of color, racialized women are not seen as human. Yeah. You know, so the violence that's perpetrated on brown bodies, on indigenous bodies is kind of. It fits into that hierarchy that Eileen talks about in the Missing Women Project.
Well, it was also a slightly different time, too. I mean, this is a time where the quote-unquote medical field was just kind of burgeoning, and they were, like, digging up people's graves.
Yeah.
It was, you know, we often remember that this is happening. These atrocities are happening on the backdrop of a lot of other kind of, like, messed up things. Mm-hmm. As well, and which is not to say that it's to take away from the idea that the racialized violence that she wasn't subjected because of you know, where she'd come from, her ancestry, but is also in the context of a lot of just crazy things happening in terms of quote unquote medical research and so on and so forth.
But you know, again, like that continues to this day. We see it through the violence perpetrated on the environment, and that ties into the violence that's perpetrated towards women, you know, with the RCMP, that 82-page report on the, you know, the violation. And I know it's not just women who are victims of, you know, the power hierarchy violence, but you know, we can't talk about it like it was something in the past. Even in the medical industry, they go into jails, right? And they just experiment on people.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And I'm sort of discovering this more in my own research as well, is that the history of nations is very frequently built on gendered violence. And in particular, like in the cases of South Asia, when India, Pakistan were created, the violence was, I would say, like overwhelmingly gendered violence, and it was targeted rape and campaigns of it taking place in which these people were like humiliated and murdered. And it's one of the great atrocities, like where over 1 million people died. The numbers of the of people who were raped or abused in that partition, and these were kind of dismissed as birthing pains by male historians largely, and it was these stories did not come out until much, much, much later. Mm-hmm. And
yeah. I mean, again, that's what happened here, you know, that's what happened to, you know, and it continues to happen. And that's, I think that's the nature of colonization. That's how you conquer a people, is to go in and destroy the bloodline, the woman, you know, who carries the family. And it's always an attack on women and children. You steal the children, you break the children, you steal the women, you rape the women, you know.
Yeah, well, that's definitely conquest culture, right? That's what you're, quote-unquote, supposed to do. And, like, the idea of, like, nationalism, native, that's comes from the verb up to birth, right? Yeah. Like, so the idea of, like, controlling that function in this particular region of birth is very much tied to the idea of conquest.
And, I mean, it led in historically in communities like the Jews switching lineage to matrilineal lines as opposed to patrilineal lines because they knew that Judaism would be extinguished because they would stop them from breeding. But if the women were going to carry the Jewish bloodlines, then they would save their people. Because even if a woman was purchased by a slave master, her children would be Jews, and so that would be a protection that they would have for their own culture and their own people. That's their heritage. They know
it
well.
And that's literally the opposite of what happened here, whereas if an indigenous woman marries a white man, she loses status, her children lose status, and immediately the identity is colonized and appropriated, and you know, yeah.
That's interesting point, like the idea of like the nation as, you know, they call, you know, as a her, like it's like that just made me think about that, like nation is like referred to as like
it's feminine typically.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, birth, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
A nation means people of common birth.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's the fatherland, and you're like in India, they refer to it as Bharat Mata, which is the like Mother India, you know? Mm-hmm. And because I think it fits in also with a certain rhetoric about how people see animal and like animals sort of willingly give themselves up, like their flesh and their and the products that come from them, that this kind of so that a lot of sort of the image of the cow in particular is that it provides milk for you, provides sustenance for you. I don't know if it's willing, but it comes from that logic, like it's like a nourishing mother. Mm-hmm. That sort of lets you suckle.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a interesting superimposition, mm-hmm. to say the least.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's when I hear about gender-based violence, it's like, for me, it's almost always linked to the ideas of conquest and hierarchy and expressions or maintaining those things. And, you know, and part of the scary thing is like, how many of us don't come from a line of that? We would, right? Mm-hmm. In some sense.
That's that's exactly one of the things that we were addressing today at the Urban Alliance conference is looking at, you know, generational violence and how, you know, for when you have that conquest oppression, and obviously, I mean, we weren't focusing too much on the male perspective. It was very much about the female perspective. But when you look at who's perpetrating violence, often it is in our own communities. Often it's our fathers, brothers. And there was a lot of talk about the brothers and how, you know, they can't be left out of that dialogue, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it probably has a lot to do with just that, like you're saying, the hierarchy and that colonial concept of gender roles and how emasculated racialized men are, mm-hmm. through that system, right? So mm-hmm. in turn they're perpetuating that violence.
Yeah, I remember I attended a talk in Atlanta where Bell Hooks was discussing that as well, and she was commenting at length about like how women have to carry the burden of redeeming their men. And when I first heard it, I felt really annoyed because I felt powerless in that relationship. Mm-hmm. But in many ways, I can see why it has to happen in that direction. And the more I've read and the more I've thought about it, the more it's made sense. Just initially, I think always that reaction is that when you lump men together as a category, then white dominant, the sort of white colonizers get grouped with brown slaves and colonized, and that becomes troublesome. But in many ways, the hierarchies and structures of like men and women repeat at every level of society. It's just was it Isabel Allende who said that beneath the poorest, weakest man is a woman. Still, a woman and a child. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. I mean, and we have to always keep that in mind, I think.
Mm. Yeah, and it's also remember, like with the whole conquest culture that we all live in, benefit from. Because as we're sitting here, you know, our tax dollars are going to go fund somebody who's
the headphones we're wearing, the energy we're using. It's all tied into that.
It all comes mm-hmm. from that. Mm-hmm. We live in a violence-based culture.
Yeah.
You know, and it's kind of like, that's one of the, I always say it's one of the currencies of society in a sense. And it's most violence is actually male-male, mm-hmm. you know, most frequently. It's because of particular gender constructs that we, and I think rightfully, recognize that male violence on women is different from male-male violence, you know, but like, oftentimes when we talk about violence and gender-based violence, it's like we do overlook the fact that if I'm going to be assaulted or if I'm going to assault somebody, it's most commonly someone who's of the same gender rather than someone who's not.
Right. But they found also that in male hierarchy making, it's I find this amongst jurists a lot, and from centuries that are not our own. But like when they do the research about whether if they're condemning something like homosexuality, the punishments are much harsher for the person who's behaving like a woman in that relationship, which is again kind of interesting. So that the entire even structure of male relationships to each other is in terms mm-hmm. of who's the weaker partner, mm-hmm. who's the female partner in mm-hmm. this relationship right. or in this mm-hmm. issue. And it's kind of interesting because it keeps remapping that kind of
binary.
Yeah, yeah exactly. Over and over.
Yeah.
And also the idea of punish the weak, mm-hmm. right? That's like you mm-hmm. it's a disincentive for being weak, right? That's part of the...
But see, that's where the problem lies, because femininity doesn't mean weak. Femininity and being feminine and being, you know, female, that does not equate with weakness.
But it's framed that way in a patriarchal
I know, kind of way. And that's the problem.
When strength is described as physical, being able to have like a certain particular physical ability...
And to conquer
and to do that, it is to that degree. It tends to be, less having. I wouldn't say it's less agency, but there's a certain difference in terms of masculine energy mm-hmm. and feminine energy in that regard. And so, in terms of like that male supremacist type culture, it's like, well, punish the weak because you learn to think of weak as female, mm-hmm. Even though it's not necessarily true.
Yeah, because there are some women I know who could sweep the floor with some men. Oh, no. You know what I mean? Like, it's...
Trust me, I know.
Yeah. I know. Like, and that's why I'm just saying that, though. Like, we need to be careful about how we deconstruct that, because mm-hmm. we don't want to perpetuate that, right? We need to be mindful of that language, because I just have a real problem with framing females as weak, because I think that perpetuates the violence. It allows... Because... They're like what you're saying, and I get your point. It's like it's qualifying weakness to be something that should be conquered, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's creating it in terms of its own incentive structure,
right?
Right, and how we tend to what we think weak is, right? And mm-hmm. what we think strong is. Mm-hmm. It's not the whole entire truth at all, mm-hmm. but it's the way we come to think of things, and then we set up these systems of punishments and rewards through culture that kind of try to reinforce that idea or that logic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the weird little places that I find it tends to survive, as well as sometimes with doctors, I found that male doctors like to tell male patients to make them feel strong that, you know, that's probably just as painful as childbirth. And whenever I hear that, I'm like, how would you know?
And then, how would you ever know that? Yeah, ever, as a male? Like, ever.
And I'm wondering...
Never.
How exactly?
Spoken as someone who had 38 hours of labor.
Yeah, I. You see, I think that's that's an incommensurable category. I don't think I can understand that. Like, and I'm quite comfortable and in some ways pleased that maybe I won't have to
deal with that, right?
That level of pain.
That way to own that privilege. Although no, I say it's not a privilege. It's a privilege to be a woman.
Yeah,
to be able to give birth to a child.
I cook for the very same reason. That is my creative act. That is my life-giving act.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you too, because you two, you two male cisgendered identified men. No. What I was going to say is, of you two in particular, are both people I identify as you know, having a good sense of, you know, these things. So I don't feel that you come with a lot of bullshit privilege that we need to unpack right away. I mean, I'm sure you guys both have it, but
oh yeah.
And I know you do because I've seen it, but it's not always like it's not as dominant as it can be in other men. But what do you feel is your responsibility as both of you as brown men to work towards creating you know, I don't know if it's some kind of healing or safe space or something towards the prevention of this gender-based violence?
Well, in part, I found that when I was working in residence here at U of T, the places where these kind of conversations take place tends to be when you're sitting in a mixed company or women talking to women, as opposed to men talking to men about like what's appropriate and what's right and how you should treat women or how you should talk about women or even or just others generally who are not going to fit a certain hetero male model. Mm-hmm. And I think those kind of conversations are so important to have because it not only disrupts what is typically thought about how men talk to men. But it also allows people to have these discussions in a very frank fashion, and also in that case, condemn what's wrong. Like if you see a guy catcalling a woman, like I call people on that stuff. I don't like to let that pass because I just it offends me profoundly. And it's not because I think of every woman as my sister or my mother. I think that's really reductionist. I just think it's offensive to do that to another being, period.
For me, it's kind of understanding the dynamics that create those situations or reactions in primarily men. And I found in my experience, secondary experiences, that it's often, like I said, a kind of conversation of violence. It's rare that a guy just gets out of bed and says, you know what, today I'm going to do whatever. So it's like what things in his experience tells him that, you know what, violence is a reasonable way of communicating. Mm-hmm. And try to short-circuit those things. And also be aware of the reality that violence, again, it's in our community. Females enact violence, and then men often respond with violence. So to help him recognize that if you're in a potentially violent situation with somebody, whatever the gender, what are the reactions that what are your responsibilities in terms of recognizing that and positioning yourself in a way so that you don't perpetuate those things? Mm-hmm. I find that sometimes the chivalric responses of terms of don't do this or you should never do that, put your jacket down, like that kind of leads to a type of kind of, I think because there's already so much conditioning, it kind of perpetuates this kind of ownership model of females. And so oftentimes in our society, ownership is also tied to violence. So if we're reinforcing this ownership type mentality through these whatever gestures, I think we're indirectly encouraging violence in that sense, or the potential for violence, because we often have an exchange type sense of relationships. Like, I behave this way, then therefore you behave that way. So if I behave this way and then you don't behave that way, well, that's a disrespect, and therefore I'm going to check you, and I check you how I've seen other people get checked, and it's like this. Mm-hmm. That's what I've seen, how I've seen some violence unfold. Mm-hmm. So in terms of that regard, doing things to try to short-circuit that, challenge that, those kinds of understandings of people and relationships. Mm-hmm. So as to defuse the overall situation. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting going back to that property kind of and ownership kind of thing over in relationship, or how that gets played out, that chivalry and like, I'll protect you as long as you do this. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So, and if you don't, I'm able to...
Then it's somehow seen as okay. Like today, one of the panelists was talking about somebody from her community who had been murdered, had gone missing. She was 4.5 months pregnant, and then was eventually, you know, her remains were found, and it turned out to be the father of the baby, the unborn baby. And his reasoning was that she was promiscuous, and he didn't believe the child was his. And so he strangled her, and then he stripped her, and her body was quite, you know, abused when they found it, and buried her in his backyard. And then apparently during the trial, the amount of support for him overwhelmed the amount of people who were representing for her. So, you know, there, like you're saying, like there is that sense of like a female's agency in her own sexual, you know, identity is valued based on her relationship to the man, right?
And this imaginary or this invisible contractual arrangement between males and females, you know, where it's like, well, because I've done this as a man, you therefore shall behave in these three ways. Yeah. And if you don't,
it's somehow justified. Yeah. It justifies whatever action is follows from that,
right? Yeah. It's very complicated dynamics, because at the same time I've seen situations where I've been in situations where it's violence is every day, like, you know, you step outside, it's there. Mm-hmm. And you'll see like young women getting with a dude who's known to be the most violent dude, right? Because the idea is, well, there's only one person that can who can trouble me. It's going to be this person. Mm-hmm. If I'm with this other person, you know, I'm actually more vulnerable, mm-hmm. right? So it's just this kind of how the way that patriarchal culture and like the culture of violence and exchange kind of herds women in mm-hmm. in this particular kind of way and making them, you know, oftentimes see violence as strength.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And valuing yeah. that in a partner yeah. because yeah. of
some
they
kind could of protect you.
They can protect you from other violent
illusion.
Men.
Yeah. Yeah. Illusion. And it's an illusion, yeah. right? Having that yeah. protective relationship, yeah. It's a farce.
It depends. Because,
well, yeah, you're right. I mean, if you're talking about somebody who will turn that on you if you, you know, looked at his friend the wrong way well, or, yeah. you know.
But that's only one person that can do that. If you're with, if you're by yourself, there's 30 people who could do that to you potentially. But if you're with this person, that's the only one person you have to worry about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem is that women, and that's a big thing, like as a female, I don't know, Mally, what your thoughts are on this, but I know, you know, being raised the way I was, you know, had pretty sheltered, despite some of the stuff, there was a lot that was sheltered as a female, right? And having that, always having the awareness that you're vulnerable, always mm-hmm. feeling like you have to be on your guard and watching your back and being aware of your surroundings and, you know, being taught to, thankfully, you know, I had family who taught me to look people in the eye when you're passing them on the street mm-hmm. and like don't look down, like look up, be aware, you know. But those are just even walking with that can create fear, right?
Yeah, that's something I hadn't really appreciated as a man particularly. I mean, and it's strange because, like, you know, if you're a black guy growing up in Toronto, you know that I go to a club, might get shot, might get shot, you know, look at the police, might get shot. So there is that sense, but it's, I don't know. That was something I kind of carried and I didn't really think much about. But I remember I was in this situation. It's kind of funny, right? I used to work at an adult's store, right?
What?
This is from the Griffin Files. Like, you're not supposed to know about this, but you know? So I used to work at this adult store, right?
What?
This is back in the day. And, you know, I'm not a small dude. I'm a, you know, decent size. So usually I feel pretty good in situations. So it's late night. It's like 11:30. The door opens and it's this just monster of a man. He's like 6'5", 6'4", maybe 250. And I'm like, this guy's a beast, right? I'm like, okay, cool. So I'm just sitting there trying not to really, you know, be cool,
yeah.
whatever. So he walks in there and he's like, he's looking at these videos. He's like, oh, let's go over to the guys section. I'm kind of like, yeah, I don't really know nothing about those videos, but, you know, they're right there. He's like, oh, okay. Then he comes back. He's like, you know what? The only thing in this store that turns me on is you. Wow. And I'm like, oh. So I'm sitting there thinking, like, if this guy decided to try something, there was really not much I could do, except, you know, I did have, like, there was, like, a crowbar behind the behind the counter. But, like, you know, I told that to my sister, and she's laughing, right? I mean, she's like, this is how women feel every day. Mm-hmm. You know, like on a level, like every day, like whenever a woman gets into a cab with some guy, it's like, you don't know, yeah. you know? And like, that was one of the things, I was relatively young at that point, but that's one of the things that kind of drove it home. It's still easy to forget, but like the idea of like living under this regular threat, like this person in some way could violate you and on any given time. It's like the reality that women live with. And it's like,
so what happened? Creepy. What to do?
Oh, I went behind that counter and I was like, yeah, you know, was making small talk, had my hand on the crowbar. I'm like, yeah, okay, well. Sure, okay, yeah, cool. I was like, you know, you're going to lose an eye or something if you try, but like, something's happening.
I'll pry your hands off me.
Yeah. I mean, and it's funny because, I don't know, again, like, Mally, what your thoughts are as a woman on that, in that situation? There are different strategies for, you have to handle each situation differently,
The
right?
thing is, I think, you know, I'm trying to think of, you know, because there's been times where, usually generally in Toronto, I've never really, I don't know, I'm rare, I've never really felt anxious. Mm. Or, you know, I've been like aware of my surroundings or whatever, but I've never, that's why I'm able to go in different places really easily, because I don't, I'm not fearful, and maybe I should be, but I really am not. Mm-hmm. And I don't know where that comes from. I think it's because, I don't know. Like, I've never really felt fearful. Mm-hmm. in Toronto. I've been like fearful in situations, mm-hmm. yes, but not like, you know, generally just walking down the street or, you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's not like I'm walking around feeling but afraid all the time, but yeah. there was a time actually, and it has a lot to do again with how I was raised, and I know that, but there was a time where if it was nighttime, I was not comfortable. It's different for me now.
I think it's because I was pretty much moving by the time I was 11.
And you 12. And your brother are so close. Well, you're relatively close. No, you're not actually.
Age, not really. No. We're a good 5 years apart. But I was moving around the city when I was like 11. So
same here. I don't know. But
I don't know.
It's,
yeah.
It's because
I've thought about that because, you know, a lot of women, they're fearful. But I've never really, you know, maybe in situations where I'm like, okay, I have to be aware. But I've never really been afraid.
Mm-hmm. Which I really
so I've been lucky,
admire that. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. It is. It's. I know some other women who don't walk with fear mm-hmm. ever, and I admire that. I think it's a nice place to be. Yeah.
I was raised with a slightly different sense because when you grow up in places like Pakistan or the Middle East or what have you, that there's cultures, you know that you're different from everyone else who can't live in a house with a wall or something or with a gated area. Like, and we were in this apartment complex that had a gate and everything. And so the outside world was kept at bay, you know? And then when you went out, there was, there's all these sort of myths that middle-class families and upper-class families will tell their kids about getting kidnapped and having your limbs cut off and being made into a beggar or something like that. So you're taught from a very young age to be always consciously aware of what's going on around you. Mm-hmm. And then also being like having Shia family members in my family and being Shia when I grew up in a place like Pakistan with a Sunni majority and now who are just like hell-bent on murdering all the Shias in Pakistan, there was this sense that you should be nervous. Mm-hmm. And like there were laws being passed that would stop two men from riding on a motorcycle because the back guy would be the gunman. Mm-hmm. And so when you used to see two guys on a motorcycle, immediately you'd start looking. You'd say like, are the faces covered? Are right. there? So there was this elevated level of tension which you would operate with the second you left your gate. Mm-hmm. And so I never felt that that it had as much of a gendered component to it as that you should always be aware. Mm-hmm. And I know that now when I'm out on the streets and stuff like that I can spot if I have someone walking behind me who's walking with an irregular pace or something and it just makes me slightly uncomfortable, I'll just step to the side, mm-hmm. let the person pass. I have that sense about me, and I'll have my friends here, especially my female friends who've grown up in places like Toronto, and we'll be walking around and I'll say like, hey, do you mind stopping for a second? I just feel a little bit weird. And they're like, why? What's going on? I'm like, well, there's like three guys across the street who've been following us for like two blocks. There's another guy behind me, like, and I'm just like a little uncomfortable. Can we just turn off down the side street and then like get back on it? And she's like, what? Like, just take my word on this. It's a bit neurotic.
It's like spidey sense kind of thing.
Yeah, it's like usually when I go into a place, I sit where I can see the door.
Yeah,
like,
same.
I want to see back what's at the wall.
Yeah, typically like that. Yeah. And I always mark like, okay, that's one exit. Entrance, where would be if someone was to come through that door, where could I run
it's survival through, like. Tactics, right? Yeah. I don't know, like any of us who have been experienced trauma or you know anything like that, like you have that sort of PTSD mark on you, right?
Yeah, a little bit to some degree.
you have to be able to assess the situation and then you know that fight or flight.
Yeah, and then also like trust your intuition, right? And like learn to vibe situations. And I think I learned that really early. Yeah. So,
but it's also too like that level of tension. Something happens with it. So when we talk about like violence in society, where does it, you know, kind of like trickle down effect? Mm-hmm. You know, where it's like if I'm walking and I have to fear Adnan, you know, or I have to fear, you know. When I go home, you know, to my wife or girlfriend or whatever, it's like that. I have this tension, and then she acts out of pocket, and the dude's gonna snap. Mm. You know, that's part of it. Like it's like there's so many layers as to
how violence gets perpetuated,
and who becomes the target of violence and why. Yeah. You know, and oftentimes it's like you have this masculinist idea of, you know, pick on the weak. Mm-hmm. And like, mm-hmm. you're, and at the same time, you're trained to see women as weak. So therefore, right. it's like, and if she's not, that's all the more reason to try to make her think so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Right? No, that's definitely yeah. true. I mean, that yeah. that's yeah. there's a real fear of strength in women.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, yeah.
And it needs to be, like, contained.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
And if you, I was just going to say, if you have something, like, it's just so many times when you have anything that to say and you get impassioned, it, as a female voice, like, that's never acceptable, right? It's always like, calm down, or you're getting emotional, right. you're getting excited, and it's like, no, I'm not, I'm fine, I'm thinking clearly, I'm an impassioned person, I speak with passion, right. and that's okay,
yeah.
it's okay, and then I have strong things to say, and that's okay too. You just have to deal right. with it, right?
But I think getting sort of impassioned in that way is often it's a real site for misunderstanding, because for me, when I think of someone getting heated or impassioned or something like that, like as someone who saw abuse and faced abuse as a child, like when that happens, I get nervous and uncomfortable, and I want to end that as fast as possible. And I don't care if it's coming from a man or a woman. Mm-hmm. I need the heatedness to leave, and I need to return to rational. And but what that the way that translates a lot, and people like my sister and my partner and other people have told me, is that translates that you're trying to silence someone from the way that they speak in their particular experience.
Yeah.
And I frequently, like, I mean, that's always the complaint, right? That women are told, calm down, or you're yes. getting emotional. And I've learned to, in time, just because of the close relationships I had with my sister and my mother and my other sisters, you know, my cousins and things like that, is that I learned how to read that very differently. And I had to learn how to connect to it very differently. And also, part about being emotional and being open is allowing yourself to feel differently and not channeling it all into the sort of registers of anger. Mm. Like, anger is the legitimate male emotion to feel publicly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that should right, not be yeah. the only one at all. Mm-hmm. And there's that, and males police males on that point heavily. Mm-hmm. And trying to disrupt that is really important, especially amongst men. Feeling is important.
But and that's exactly the way it's often framed. If a man is showing his feelings to another man, you're being a bitch, you're being a girl, you're being a little girl, yeah. right? That's the ultimate insult to say to your guy friend. Well, yeah. it's not the ultimate, but it's or
oh,
you know
yeah,
the P
it's
word,
up there, though,
right? Yeah,
girl.
Yeah. If you make that comparison, if the man is showing feelings in any kind of way, but back to the silencing thing, that's huge. And thinking about how it I mean, I understand that trigger thing very well. I think probably all of us in this room understand that, right? Having, you know, domestic violence in homes and all the different ways those things manifest, and how men perpetuate that by silencing women because they don't like the woman to be excited or upset for whatever reason, if it's because it's triggering them from their own past trauma or, you know, they're threatened by a woman's... I think it's just that they're threatened by a woman's ability to reason.
But I think it's a number of things. Like, I think the trigger, the idea of triggering is like when someone's raising their voice and they're getting... As a dude, you're typically, okay, you're raising your voice, I'm going to raise my voice, and this could escalate to whatever. So I want to cool that down. Mm-hmm. But it's also, I want to, not necessarily in the same moment, but another type of reaction could be is like, you're using my thing. I'm supposed to be the one who can raise their voice. And so you're stepping into my space. Mm-hmm. And this ability to be angry, to be passionate and do whatever, that's what, you know, that's male privilege. So you're, you know, mm-hmm. you're coming onto my territory. And like part mm-hmm. of being any kind of class structure is like, you got to keep people down.
Right.
And it's a gendered thing, but it's also a class thing. So it's kind of like, mm-hmm. as you said, like, you know, there's supposed to be a woman beneath a man and here you are trying to rise up. Well, guess what? Mm-hmm. You know, so like there's a number of things playing out in that, mm-hmm. you know, and like to qualify the little girl comment that men often make, mm-hmm. I don't know if it's just simply showing emotion. It's the idea that you're showing emotion in place of ability, right? So it's kind of like you're supposed to be doing something and instead you're going to be like whining and complaining. And so the suggestion is you're actually trying to be emotionally manipulative. You're not actually trying to produce. You're supposed to produce right now. And instead, in that place, you're being emotional and you're hoping that someone's going to do it for you.
Well, it's interesting that you would say it's emotional manipulation to show emotion, right?
Well, no, not necessarily, because I think that there are rarely, you know, prescribed ways in which men can show emotion. Like, men can cry in public. It depends on for what. So it's not just the simple thing of, like, just showing emotion is necessarily...
When you lose a game, you could cry.
When you, that's
yeah,
so
when you can't, you can't cry.
And then people cry for you.
You can't cry in public. You got to go back to the locker room
and
cry.
No, I've seen men cry.
No, I've seen it in championships
lose,
and stuff.
Oh, yeah, but they lose man points for that, though. You're not supposed to cry.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's frowned upon.
It's frowned upon, you know. Yeah. But like the little girl comment
that's one time I can see them.
Oh, there's other things. Yeah. Funerals, you can cry.
Yeah,
it's funny though when Chris Brown cried, I was not. I wasn't buying it
because he was being manipulative, right?
That was a manipulation. I felt, right. That was.
But he's all manipulative. Like.
But yeah, that was him being manipulative, right? In a sense, and like I promise you, there were some guys watching that going, "Why's this guy being a little girl up there?" Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just the fact that he was being emotional; is that here you were, in some sense, you're supposed to actually be doing the real work of learning not to be a soul. But that's interesting because little girl is an insult.
No, little girl is like, in such a negative way. Show emotion, it's manipulative.
It's still framed that way. It's still misogyny. It's still misogyny. I'm not saying that it's not, just, you know, making a slight distinction in the misogyny to understand.
It's very hateful towards little girls.
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry, but it is.
Well, like, yeah, it is. It's definitely stereotypical behavior, and it does give you a negative sense of emotion, and it is that kind of policing. And little girls,
You know, like saying...
They're at the bottom of the bottle.
If you're exactly, the worst thing you can be is a little girl, like that's a horrible thing to say.
Right. Or
that too.
And it's also... I find it that a particularly strange way of attacking someone is to, because a lot of this stuff exists in terms of people wanting to compare you to an abstract ideal. So like maleness is constructed in a particular way and femaleness is constructed in a particular way. Mm-hmm. And then the argument becomes over what is this idealized construction. But I think anytime you're working with a gendered ideal or a binary ideal like that, you're going to run into problems. And so I try as much, and this is on a very personal level, that I try as much not to abstract people from their particular experience. Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes it's unavoidable. Like someone will cut me off on the road if I'm driving, and it doesn't matter what their particular experience is. I will be screaming bloody murder. Like, it's just not pleased, right? But at the same time, if I'm having an interaction, a one-on-one interaction with someone, I'm trying to think about the last time I did this, and it's saying that, like, they're being this kind of a woman or this kind of a man. And usually I'm more comfortable with saying it about men, especially when they're this kind of like aggressive male trope. Like, I find that difficult to deal with, and I'm very dismissive of that because I don't have the patience for it. But similarly, I feel sometimes you get into that situation where you're like, oh, that's this kind of girl, where she's the kind of girl who doesn't care about this kind of stuff. All she cares about is money, gold digger, or something like that, right? Like, so when you think about it that way, you're abstracting the person out of their particular experience. So, like, if someone said, why are you having trouble with my emotion? I'm like, because I faced abuse as a child and that makes me feel uncomfortable, is very different from saying, you're emoting and I need to shut you down as a man, right? Like, my particular experience speaks to this situation. But
not everybody wants to unpack their childhood issues for every exchange, right? We are way over the half hour mark, so we have to take a very quick break and have to remind the listeners, I'm sorry to cut off at your point, but we're at like 45 minutes here. So reminding the listeners that you're listening to The Vibe Collective. We're doing a freestyle meta style. We're all at the Feminist Art Conference, but we're coming to you from the past. And
Meta styles.
And we'll be back after this very brief message on CIUT 89.5 FM.
From the roots up. CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
And we're back. So, back to your point.
I guess the point was that being willing to share our experiences and especially the particularity of our experience is meant to be empowering, because we're sort of we're making ourselves vulnerable to each other. Mm-hmm. And I think it's
but that can be dangerous. There are some spaces where that's not safe to do. Spaces where it's just not appropriate to do, right?
Sorry, something rather odd came into the studio.
Yeah.
What? People in costume and stuff.
Yeah.
Oh,
like good costume, bad costume?
No, it's just
it's not Halloween, but it's Halloween.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a bit scary.
Scary?
It was makeup and mummy kind of thing, you know?
Mummy?
But
zombies?
But then with the mask, it was weird.
Yeah. Really?
Are they still there?
No, they're in the other studio now.
They're being interviewed.
Oh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Interesting. So now I'm curious.
Yeah, we'll have to go investigate.
but vulnerability.
Yeah. No, I'm saying it's like it's interesting. It's like in a situation where knowing where someone's come from in terms of their particular experience is important, but we can't access that because it's dangerous. That speaks to the level of violence again in society, right? Where it's like the idea that if you are this person who you are,
or if you're vulnerable,
you can expect.
You might expect.
You can expect. It won't be everybody, but you can expect out of 10 people, someone is going to try to, you know? And it's like, that's violence, you know, in a sense. And that's an idea how things can perpetuate. Like one of the, I wouldn't say issues, but one of the things I try to have a more holistic idea of violence. And like physical violence is the most obvious and arguably the most dangerous kind. But it's like, it's not the only one. And the different types, they filter through, they interact, et cetera. Yep. Right. So the idea that someone can't be in society or be in a certain space and be who they are or have their experience recognized in a way that is going to be not taken advantage of in some sense, that's dangerous.
Yeah, I think that's what renders a lot of spaces that where these new spaces like the internet, it renders it into aggressive male spaces frequently, because like if you look at the forum comments, any vulnerability in that is just it's so predatory. It's so
I don't read
vicious
comments online ever. It's bad for your health. It is a waste of your time. Yeah. It will you will just, it's like chasing the carrot. You know, reading those online comments is like chasing the carrot, because you're never gonna crack those eggs.
Yeah, if you want a grim view of humanity.
Yeah, you don't want you don't want to have that kind of view of people. I don't know. It seems it's unproductive for me.
I always read them. I don't know.
I know. You do.
It's like an insatiable appetite you have.
I know.
For the trolls. Can we talk about your troll friend, by the way? I don't want to on air, because I don't want to give him any space. But we need to talk about that guy.
Oh, that dude.
That guy.
What? Oh. Troll. Who is he?
I don't know. I like trolls, man.
You
I
do.
Like
you trolls. Love the trolls. You're trolling for trolls.
Oh, I troll for trolls. I'm the troll hunter. Hunter. I'm like Blade. I'm that dude.
You are.
That guy was out of hand.
But I don't understand. At the end of the day, I might go in for a minute, but don't. At the end of the day, don't you get tired? Because you know it's just going to go in circles.
Oh no!
It's
usually
circular logic.
That's usually my approach with trolls. Is like, I just try to use their reactions to prove something that I already said that they disagreed with.
Yeah.
Because oftentimes they're pretty predictable, right? And it's kind of like, it's more about showing other people, like, if you think like this dude, you have a problem. Right? Yeah. I don't expect that he's going to wake up tomorrow and be like, you know what Adrian said? It's really going to change my trollish ways.
No, because he has brown friends who say he's right.
Right, so
and black and Nigerian friends who say he's right.
Well, there you go. Right?
One Nigerian friend says he's right, and everybody else was wrong. All the 25 other people I feed were wrong, but his Nigerian friend says he's right. So,
but you know what? He sent that guy $5,000 to make sure. Sorry. See,
that was a crazy moment.
No, but that's what it is. Where it's like,
it's ridiculous.
Oftentimes with you know, I'm very particular in my troll hunting, right? It's like
I'm gonna get this guy.
No, I like trolls that seem like regular people. So like they start saying like things that sound like, well, that doesn't sound unreasonable, you know? But like there's a certain, usually there's a certain way they say it, or just a certain timing, yeah, and
no,
it's like,
no, it's like having a radar, a gaydar. You have a racistar. No, you have a trolldar.
So it's like, yeah. So originally, like if you look at that conversation, there were people who were agreeing with them. It's like, yeah, that's a good point. And I was like, oh, really? And then just kind of let it spiral and see, this dude's crazy.
Yeah.
But you were agreeing with him before, so that's how I typically. That's why I read the comments and engage trolls.
You just love to stir the pot.
A little bit.
Yeah.
a little stir pot. There.
Yeah.
Modified cabbage patch. You can't see it in the studio.
Yeah. Oh my goodness.
That guy was fun. I actually went in after I had the conversation.
I saw you going in after. I'm like, I'm not touching him anymore. I had my say. I'm done.
It lasted for 2 seconds. I was like, wow.
Yeah, but that's.
But he went after me.
Oh yeah, he came.
And another thread. That I wasn't even involved in.
Word
I'm
up.
Like, what the. No, you don't know me. You do not know me like that.
And then I was like, what?
You know, honestly, I see enough of this happening, even like in the hallowed halls of academia, right? Like, so the stuff takes place, and I have the same reaction. I just run. I'm like, I see that this is troll country, and I get gone.
I just, you're like, I'm a hobbit. I'm out of here.
Not a fan.
I mean, but at a time, like I joke, but like part of it is like, for whatever reason, maybe one day in one of my memoirs, I'll break this down. But like, same thing, like traveling through schools or, you know, academia, like I was attacked by trolls like all the time, like for saying things that I thought were rational or things that I just thought were just what says here in the book, the same thing. I just
repeated it.
And people are at you. So it's like after a while, it's like if I'm going to move through this space, I'm going to have to know how to deal with
the insanity, because it's they create these illusions, like saying things like, well, you did this and you never did that, or you say that, you said all white people are racist. No, I did not say that.
That's again, that's one of the beauties of the internet. Where it's
it's all there.
Can you show me where I
just
said
scroll
that?
Scroll back. Yeah, exactly.
Can you show me where you said where
yeah,
I said that?
Yeah,
they can't do it, right?
Calling you the black KKK. Come on,
that's so crazy.
I'm like, who told him? How do you know?
It's the black hood.
It's like, I do my own dry cleaning. How do you know?
Oh my God. But that's what's so crazy making for me. That's why I don't with the trolls anymore. Oh. Because it's crazy making, and in the past having to deal with it, like the East End, right? All the racism in that neighborhood. Like you just.
No, for me, it's practice. Crazy. It's practice. Because like in real life, I've had to deal with situations kind of like that, and it's like, let me just practice on the internet, man, because like it's just gonna happen worse in real life.
But it always plays out the same way, doesn't it?
For the most part, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, you know,
yeah. It's, like it's not. You're never going to.
He had a rope. I knew. Invincible ignorance. After a while, I was like, I know what he's going to say next.
Exactly. You can predict it. It's a script. It's like there's crazy, one of 25 to 30 things that racist people say.
He's going to call me
privileged, entitled, racist people.
Lazy and stupid.
Exactly.
And he ended up doing.
He did.
That.
He did. Yeah.
I was like, wow, that's typical.
But the beauty is that he's not your typical racist, right? In the sense of. He identifies as liberal. You
that's
know.
A typical racist.
No,
what do you mean?
That, no, that
how
was
do you
pretty
mean?
Typical no. racist.
He was so typical.
No.
He's somebody who thinks he hides it well.
Right.
But he doesn't. He does not.
Right.
He's very obvious.
You know, he's liberal. He's progressive.
He's got Nigerian friends.
He has friends of all races. I have family of all races.
Yes. Yes, family.
Right. That's not what you typically think of when
He's okay with interracial breeding.
But convinced, and his whole argument was based on Adrian was against it. That was the other hilarious thing.
That was,
this assumption that he was clinging to, that Adrian doesn't believe in interracial
No miscegenation. Repeal with it, love versus whatever. Yes, that's me. I'm that guy. Right? So
Yeah, because you're the black KKK.
I'm the black KKK who does his own dry cleaning.
Exactly.
And so it was like to just, for me, the appeal was like showing that racist ideas survive all those things? Because there is actually a conversation among people saying, well, you know, if you vote for the liberals, you really can't be a racist. I'm like, oh, yeah. You know,
if
so.
If you have a Nigerian friend, you're not racist. If you have black family, you're not racist.
I think if you ever find yourself in any circumstance saying that I have blank friends,
that's what I'm saying. Exactly.
Defense, like, I've got lots of gay friends. Of course, I understand other community. Like,
if you have to bring up other people, yeah, to validate your behavior is probably.
But this is the other thing. I mean, how this is the audacity, and again, it comes down to entitlement. And just to throw back to Tom Flanagan and the sense of entitlement he had, so much so that he didn't. Someone was interrupting him right before he said the man boy love association thing.
To save him.
And he, not even to save him, they were angry because he was he had already said that he didn't feel anyone was being hurt by looking at child pornography. And then someone interrupted him, but he's so entitled to anything he does that he went ahead and said it and didn't have any sense of how wrong it was. Your troll was being told by how many people in that feed? He's having a public dialogue, right? Mm-hmm. And how many people in that feed were like, hello, yeah, no, that was problematic. Enough people, more than four.
Right, yeah, but also too, you know, me
that
being...
That went on for like a day and a half.
me being the observer of human behavior. Like, I look at that as whitening behavior. Like, that's mm-hmm. how a person test the limits of their privilege. It's like, how irrational can I be? How far can I get away with stuff? It's not about necessarily...
I don't think it's a conscious thing, though. I think sense of entitlement to their thoughts, their beliefs. They're so unable to understand experience outside of their own that they don't have the ability to deconstruct anything.
It might be so practiced that it's unconscious, but I think that there's a level of consciousness. I personally feel there's a level of consciousness too. It's like, how can I, like Quentin Tarantino, like what is that? Like, to me, that's what I call whitening behavior, where it's like, well, one of the kinds of whitening behavior, where it's like, I'm going to see just how crazy I can take this privilege thing. How far, like, and how can I get, how far can I take this before people react? And when they react, how can I just kind of just weave and dodge and go through it?
And then also, who am I going to get on side?
And right? Who can I get on side? Yeah, so that's I think, a way of like kind of one of the neurotic reactions to the idea of, oh, well, my privilege is in crisis. Mm-hmm. How can I shore it up or how can I test it? Mm-hmm. That's just one of my pet theories, you know?
I mean, mm-hmm. I just know how I look at it in my own life, the white privilege that I've carried, and I look at it in my family. I don't, again, like being mixed, so I don't know that I have the white perspective necessarily, but I do have the white privilege perspective. And it's not something that you necessarily have a consciousness of until you've taken the time to deconstruct it, right? People don't necessarily know they're privileged. And this is where it becomes a problem. They don't think people are oppressed. They think people are lazy. They think people are given a free ride. They think people have had enough breaks as it is. You know, they don't necessarily see the privilege they carry, I don't think.
No, I think the privilege is invisible in some ways.
In a lot of people.
With some people, there's that. But there's also the people who... they work in the cultural industry. So like a Quentin Tarantino who went to a black high school and considers himself black. Yeah. It's like, he knows, you know, he's seen it up front to a degree.
Yeah.
People who have, I have Nigerian friends, et cetera. It's like, you know, to some degree that their oppression exists and
But some of the most racist people towards indigenous people are people who live right next to reserves.
Oh yeah.
Right.
Like, imagine.
You don't necessarily get it through osmosis. Like you are going to see the world through the lens that you see it through. And I think for people like this troll, I think that, you know, it's a real sense of entitlement, yes. But I don't think they're aware of that.
Well,
I don't think their intelligence is far reaching enough to break that down.
I mean, ones.
Well, some of them. Maybe some of them know.
Well, the internet ends up privileging a particular kind of intelligence, particular kind of approach, because when people speak of something like emotional intelligence, you can't have that on the internet unless, except in certain cases where, like, people have done like a really impassioned plea on like YouTube or something like that. But then, I always feel that kind of stuff ends up bordering on like emotionally manipulative behavior as well, because like very frequently it's tied to cause or something like that. Mm-hmm. Or you find that you're using the internet in a very particularized fashion, which you're kind of getting an emotional release out. So like they'll have those, there's this entire culture now of like bad guys, right? Like so the military and stuff like that, generating all these coming home videos that you can't but cry at. If you watch these things, it's just like seeing especially your daddy the for child, the first time, like in 2 years, and the child is crying and the parents crying, and it's just they're generating this tons of emotional capital for the military.
Emotional capital.
Like I don't, that really bothers me.
But that's the thing, is like we often think that intelligence is always used to the ends we think are intelligent, you know, oftentimes not, you know, or we think it looks a particular way, oftentimes not. And intelligence can look in so many different ways and have so many different directions, you know, like, you know, if you're going to apply like a physics type of description to it, like intelligence would be, I think it's velocity doesn't have direction. It just a rate of change over distance, whatever that, and speed has direction, right? So we're talking about speed to a degree of saying, well, this guy, he wouldn't do this if he were intelligent. It's like, he just might be in a way that we just think reprehensible.
No, for sure. I think it's a lack of emotional intelligence for people who don't understand how privilege operates.
And the thing is like that, the idea, sorry to interrupt you. Finish what you want to say. No, I was saying like, you know, how the left tends to, we've spoken on about this before, how the left kind of deems the right as unintelligent, which I think is very dangerous, right? Because they attach intelligence to, you know, I guess the good, I guess. But I think that's a dangerous thought. Like, you know, Bush is seen as unintelligent, and you know, Harper's intelligent, and I don't believe that.
I think it goes back to what Adrian was saying, though. It's a type of intelligence that they have, exactly. And then they're lacking in another type of intelligence, like empathy, right?
Right. Yeah.
Having emotional intelligence includes having the ability to empathize with human beings, and I don't believe Harper can, and I don't believe
he's a sociopath.
He's a sociopath, Tom Flanagan, the same thing. You know, talking about child pornography in such a flippant, casual way. And as though, you know, it's not really hurting anybody, not considering the victims that might be involved, right, with the pictures.
I think people can even use emotional intelligence to nefarious ends, you know?
Well, like that's a super criminal
like bad medicine. Yeah. People using bad medicine everywhere.
Exactly. So but
any type of intelligence or whatever, it can be used in whichever kinds of ways. And I feel like some of the people who engage in what I call this kind of racist whitening type behavior, like, or border or power testing type behavior. Some of them are like either they've gotten lazy and sloppy, like I think might have happened with Flanagan, or they never really kind of had it, like what seems to be the case with Prime Minister Harper. Mm-hmm. But with other kinds, it's like everything is clicking. They're just wiring it differently. You know, like they can perceive, they can empathize, they can do all those things. And what's important to them is maintaining privilege, and to have these kind of like border keeping prejudices that manifest or mask as simple ignorances when they're not. They're very developed and skilled biases that keep them moving in a direction that they feel comfortable.
That's how it's sustained, right?
Certainly.
That's how,
and that's applied to even like going back to the idea of violence and male privilege. It's applied in those cases too, because a lot of times people say that men aren't particularly emotional, but I've known, like I've grew up around people who were deeply, skillfully abusive, and they could read your emotions on the way you're holding your head, the way that your shoulders move. Like they are very attuned to your emotions. They can imagine how you feel, but their concern is, how can I use that to make you feel even worse? Mm-hmm. It's not about how can I help you become a better, freer person. You know, so these different privilege-keeping intelligences, be they reflected along a gender axis or a racial axis or a class axis, they often depend on really a careful sense of emotion and not just this script, because people who are oppressed are intelligent. They're full functioning beings. So how can you keep them down if you can't see how they think or how they feel? It that won't work. So a lot of these people, yes, you have some people who get lazy and sloppy, but oftentimes you're dealing with a kind of intelligence that is not immediately recognized, partly because we say, oh, it seems like stupidity.
But I think that there are those who carry that intelligence, but then there are those who subscribe to it. And there was a study about the lower IQ of the right. And I agree with you that we have to be careful. It's dangerous to say they're stupid, but I think there are some people who are programmed to need, and this is what the study was saying, that they need consistency. They need things to be stabilized in a particular framework that is, mm-hmm. you know, privileged to them, right?
Yeah.
Although I'm going to object to using IQ as a measure, because like even in my experience, like I when I first came to America, they asked all these questions. They asked this questionnaire to like locate me in my class and where I should belong and stuff like that. And the questions were all structured around racially biased categories, or particularly ethnically, or even by location, east or west. Fire trucks are not red all over the world. Mm-hmm. And that was a question on this exam. And I didn't know that American fire trucks were all red. And so I answered the question wrong. And I got stuck in a class with a bunch of kids who were like similarly misplaced because mm-hmm. they didn't know how to deal with them. Yeah. And so they ended up making us, just their solution to dealing with them, with dealing with us, was to not push us in any way at all, and just let us float.
Just do whatever.
And it wasn't until I started coming home to my parents and saying that I'm not learning anything, and this is really bothering me, and that they kind of tried to figure out how to restructure that or move me, and they ended up moving schools because the school just didn't have the capacity to deal with that, nor the desire to deal with someone who was an outlier to a particular system that they were implementing. And so that felt really bizarre, because I had never felt stupid in my life, but here I was being told I was profoundly stupid. And it was very strange. And because I didn't have the right information or the right technology. And I find it's very easy to get baited into calling people like the right, saying that they're dumb or they don't get it. In many cases, it's just that their particular experiences and their particular orientation have been to value certain registers over others. And I think that to have meaningful dialogue between us and them is to kind of make it identifiable, make it relatable, make it something that we feel like together, as opposed to we're just preaching at them. Because I think that's always the problem with people have with like vegans or animal rights activists, especially, right? Like these are the target categories, even for people who are on the left, because they're like, oh, they've gone beyond the pale. Like they're not even speaking a language that we can speak anymore. How are we meant to not have leather belts? You know, like the only belts that last and stuff like that. So like, and we have a tendency to belittle because to an animal rights activist, we all look crazy, right? Like, and we have to keep that in mind too. That like, and
it's like the paradigm they're in, kind of.
Right.
Thing.
It's just it's like a sense of like how to and I think if we start feeling that the categories are incommensurable or that they can't be broken down, we can't actually have meaningful conversations. That's where we get stuck. And it's just kind of making these spaces possible. And the only way they can do that is that we share a common humanity, right? And so we share a humanity in the sense that we can feel, we can connect, we can love each other, we can care about each other. And that has to be something to start with, right? And it's much more difficult when someone's punching you in the face, but like it's easier when you can sit around a coffee table and talk. So.
But it's also difficult. Like it doesn't always have to be as overt as someone punching you in the face. It could be just someone like, you know, dumping their privilege all over the space, right? And in different ways, or their entitlement. And then it becomes problematic because, you know, you could choose your battles, and I've done this, you know, where you don't respond and you just kind of be the quiet voice because you don't want to, you know how it's going to go. I know you probably wouldn't, but you know how it's going to go. So you decide not to say anything, but the whole experience is then tainted. Like I know I'm sitting there triggered. I'm like feeling like, you know, alienated from the group and, you know, and you feel, you feel a way about it. But if you do address it, then again, you're likely going to be even more alienated from the group. And you're going to have to be willing, you have to have the energy to engage in the discussion and try to keep your emotional intelligence about you and not, you know, get impassioned where to the point where, you know, other people are shutting you down, because then it derails the conversation anyways, right?
Yeah.
But you know what? We are like at an hour and 10 minutes.
Look at that.
Okay. And we weren't even going to awesome. Do.
We're like, yeah, we'll do a short show. We'll do like, you know.
It's meta.
Yeah, meta.
Meta short show. Yeah. Not so much short.
Yeah, we, yeah.
A little spitting for the topic, because we're all, or most of us are going to be at that conference.
Exactly.
And so this is dealing with that.
Exactly.
And where is that conference for the people who might be listening and on their way there?
Yeah.
It's
at the Foundry.
At the Foundry, which is Dundas and Bathurst.
Just north of Dundas on the west side.
Across from the hospital.
Yeah, right across from the hospital. Yeah. Just on the north side end of the... Right next to the Bucks.
Yeah, the Bucks.
Yeah, the coffee shop.
You downtown people.
And then there's a funeral home as well.
Yeah, but it's not the funeral home, so go to the funeral.
No, it's the Foundry, so that's but it's feminist, in between.
Yes.
The
feminist art conference, that's what we're talking about.
It would be a cool place to celebrate life, though, at a funeral home.
That's Melinda's beige inside coming out. With
I know, the funeral.
It's down that way, then you see a funeral home.
The funeral home right across from the... I like visuals.
Just like my Google Maps.
Yeah.
Plug it in, where am I going?
That's it.
Okay, so we're the Vibe Collective. We're here every Saturday from 3 to 5. From 3 to 4, we have roundtable talks. We have reasoning sessions. We talk about decolonization, social justice, environmental justice, music, life, creation, oppression, resistance, revolution.
All the good stuff.
All of it. And then from 4 to 5, the DJs bring you music to move you. And we will be doing that coming up next. Who's up on the set? I think it's you two.
Yeah, I think it's Griffin and Badnan.
Yeah.
All
DJ
right.
Badnan.
And next week, I'm out of town.
Following. Gonna be in sunny Costa Rica.
Wow, for your sister.
Mm. Yeah, I'm very excited.
Shout outs to your sister.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Congrats.
She even donated to the show, so double shout out.
Oh, look at that.
Shout out.
Nice.
Love, big love.
Yeah,
and congratulations and good blessings.
I am super excited. I think the guy she's with is amazing.
Nice.
They're going to make beautiful babies.
Nice. Yay, babies. Okay, well, we got to go to an ad break. And just once again, if you want to find out more about us, you can follow us on Twitter. We are at Vibe Collective. You can check out our website. Thanks to Melinda, the webmistress. It is vibecollective.wordpress.com.
The Vibe Collective.
You can like us on Facebook. Like us. Go to the fan page and like us. Lots of people have been asking to join the group, which is great.
I've actually been adding people now.
Okay, good.
And then actually
redirecting
stuff,
them.
Yeah,
it's good. So, stay tuned for some music from DJs Griffin and Badnan here on the Vibe Collective, CIUT 89.5 FM.